This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Hine.
And I'm Bonnie North. We're talking about the Milwaukee area's status at or near the top of the list of most segregated metropolitan areas in the country this week during our Project Milwaukee series. It's a problem of more than just population distribution, but income levels and housing opportunity as well.
David Pate studies the complex causes, effects, and potential solutions in his role as a professor of social work at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee, and he joins us to talk about what he has learned. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here again.
What do you think that people don't understand about the way Milwaukee is segregated that they should understand?
I think it's important for people to understand that the segregation that we are currently seeing highlighted in Milwaukee is not new. There was a fabulous story written about it recently in the Shepherd magazine that was done by Reggie Jackson that really kind of laid out what historically is the reasons why we're segregated and what are the current reasons that perpetuate the segregation that we have. So this is not a new event. It's not a new phenomena. It's something that has a very strong historical presence as to why it is the way it is.
Well, and you completely anticipated my next question, which was how much does history bear on the situation here and maybe the mobility of the population? Milwaukee is the kind of place where so many people who live here today were born here. Does that play into the dynamic?
Well, I think, yeah, a lot of people were born here, but also I think when you look at it with an intersectionality perspective from race, gender, and class, many blacks came here rather late in the game when they came here to say they want to make this a place of residence and a place that will be better for their children. And when they came here, Milwaukee was at the height of its manufacturing, but at the same time, manufacturing was leaving. So they kind of missed out on some of those benefits that went along with moving to a city like a Milwaukee because Chicago was in the way and they stopped there first. And then when they got here and said, oh, there's even a better looking space, it was kind of late in the game. So some of that advantage of getting gains in for their family was not as available. So that's one of the reasons. And mobility is just hard to do when you don't have a whole lot of assets and wealth that allow you to move around in ways that other people can.
Let me just ask you this, and I it's of course impossible to turn back the clock, and mm-hmm. but hypothetically, if the African American population had arrived in Milwaukee earlier in the migration, say in the late 40s versus the late 50s and on into the mid 60s, how do you think things would have been different?
I don't know if it would have been much different, to be honest, because, one, we have 350 years, according to a book I just read by Joe Fagan, you know, there's been 350 years of segregation in our country that was perpetuated by the government as well as by the social norms based on race in particular. So for those reasons, it's hard to say it would be much different. And also people lived in segregated neighborhoods forever. I mean, that's just been the way it has been. But people also had jobs, which made it much easier to tolerate some of the issues that go along with a segregated neighborhood without the infrastructure that allows them to be able to have their families move into a space where they're comfortable and safe and not worrying about other issues that go along with being impoverished.
So when we talk about segregation, we can't distance that talk from the idea that we're not just talking about segregation, we're talking about poverty.
Yes, you have to. Because what William Julius Wilson talks about a lot in his book, When Work Disappears, when you look at neighborhoods in particular that are segregated, that are black, that also have lack of infrastructure such as jobs and commercial programs that really could help them, that makes a big difference as to how whether or not that community survives in a way that doesn't have some of the issues that go along with being impoverished, which could be a rise in violence, it could be a rise in perpetuated segregation. And also, like Matt Desmond talks about in his book Evicted, many families on the north side of Milwaukee believe that they're supposed to be segregated. That's a norm. That's something they have to accept as a way of life. So even in more recent publications that have been well-respected and received in our country, and you put Milwaukee on the spotlight, you can see that there's some normalizing of thinking that this is the way my life is supposed to be and that the reason that other people don't accept me in their communities is something I should receive as an acceptable way of living.
Well, let me ask what maybe is an impolitic question here, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you think if there were large, predominantly African-American middle-class neighborhoods, would this not be an issue or would we not be talking about it in these same terms?
I think it wouldn't be as much of an issue. I mean, places like Atlanta is very middle class and doing very well economically. In fact, it's very hard to find housing there now because it's so expensive. Places in Washington, D.C., which are also very segregated by race, and people are very middle class, are doing very well because they have a job. They have a school that works. They have many of the infrastructures that neighborhoods such as a Waukesha or Wauwatosa or Oconomowoc have that, you know, it makes for a family to be able to take care of themselves and to be in a space where they don't have to worry about other things that may be compromising their well-being.
One of the striking statistics that emerges as you look at the state of things here is that even middle and upper class blacks are much more likely to live in a neighborhood with concentrated poverty than whites or to some degree Latinos. Do you have insights into what's going on to cause that dynamic?
I mean, part of it is, and people who I've talked to in terms of the impact of segregation and what it means is that there is a comfort level with being with people who you know and your family here. So family does stabilize people and also keep them situated in spaces where if you have a sick mom or a sick dad or a sick relative or you know the healthcare system is accessible to your child who may have asthma or autism or some other issues, you're going to stay located there because you know that space, you trust that space. And also, there's not very many cities in the country where for blacks who are middle class or upper middle class can move where they feel safe or they feel like they're going to be accepted and tolerated. In fact, only 15 cities in this country have a large concentration of blacks where they can feel very comfortable. And also, if the job is here, it's hard to leave a job, particularly in this economy right now. So there's a number of factors that make that a lot more difficult for anybody across any class level, but particularly for blacks who are trying to find a place of comfort.
Is there also some notion of investment in the neighborhood that if you're a middle or upper class African-American, you're in a position where you might feel like you can make some change?
Oh, definitely. That's a really good point you make, that some people, and it's commendable, that people do see that as a reason that they want to give back to their community. You're taught that in church. You're taught that in school. You may be taught that in your family. You may be a political person who really feels invested in making sure that you maintain whatever that investment you have in your neighborhood. And we see that in Milwaukee, some of the families who are still here who are invested in making sure that people see that they have a voice and they want to have a voice. So I think some of it is just a lack of available mobility that you like to have that other people don't have. And one of this for blacks is it's much harder to do that.
So is there any, I don't know, silver bullet's the wrong word here, but is there any single simple explanation for why poverty has become the endemic issue it has in African-American neighborhoods? I mean, is employment the, I mean, obviously employment is the key here.
Well, you know, we have to go to that before World War II and after World War II. Of course, there were segregated neighborhoods. Segregated neighborhoods became much more of a real issue after World War II when FHA loans were available, and they weren't as available to black soldiers returning. And in fact, the real estate market purposely made it that if you had a black family in your neighborhood, that it was seen as a risky neighborhood, and redlining became a real issue. So, and as we know, housing is the main reason that people are able to accumulate wealth. It's like you live in your safe deposit box or your savings account, rather. You live in a space that you're going to be able to do things for your family that other people can't do. So when you don't have any assets beyond your day-to-day paycheck, it makes it much, it just causes more issues. And if you don't have a real strong tax base of home ownership, then you can't have those things that other people have in their community. And that causes poverty. I mean, when you don't have that strong tax base that's going to allow you to do things, it makes it impossible.
So given these issues, when you look at ways to start unpacking the problem and, you know, the first solution that knocks into the domino that makes the next solution easier, where does it start?
Oh, that's a really hard question, Mitch. I don't even know where to begin to answer that one. Again, some of it's the recognition of race. And what's the racial dynamics that we accept or we stereotype and we prejudge or we discriminate against based on race? That's a real issue. I mean, the 1968, Fair Housing Act made that a difference, that you can't discriminate based on race, but some of that still goes on even today and is well documented.
Can I jump in on that real quick? Because not to put too fine a point on it here, there are racists everywhere.
Yeah.
Is there something about the racial dynamic in Milwaukee that makes it a more toxic concoction in a place like Milwaukee versus a place like Atlanta or Washington, D.C.?
I don't think Milwaukee's any more racist than anywhere else. I definitely wouldn't say that. I do think there's a dynamic that in a state that is the second most segregated place in the country, and Milwaukee that is the most segregated place in the country, there's something going on there that makes a difference. Now, that started, again, we had to look at what history has done and what history means, and this is not new. And when things become normalized and you think this is a way of life and this is a way that you're supposed to live, then it's hard to change that. I mean, it requires something where it requires a much bigger initiative than some of the things that we've done. But again, also requires businesses to come back to those communities and feel that they can trust being there, that they can feel that the people who are there are valued. It's about giving people human dignity. And also people just really, I was talking to some youth last week who said that they felt the police perpetuate segregation to them. And I try to understand what they meant by that. And they gave an example of when they were at a fireworks display, and they were walked down North Avenue to Sherman and not allowed to even go in any other parts of the neighborhoods. And some of the kids lived in the neighborhoods they were passing, but they were told they could not go into those neighborhoods. What does that say to those youth, and what does it say to people when you look at your value? And it's not about racist people. It's about racist institutions or institutionalized ways of thinking that people should be treated in certain ways. That's the bigger question for me, and the bigger issue of looking at structural issues, systemic issues that make a difference.
There are people that are going to be listening to this interview, and maybe they live in a neighborhood that is majority or almost entirely African American. Maybe they're in a neighborhood that's majority or almost entirely white or mm-hmm. Latino or what have you. Mm-hmm. How do you explain to them what they lose out on by the homogeneity, if you will, of their neighborhood? What does Waukesha or Oconomowoc lose out on by having, you know, as white a place as it has? And you know, what does, you know, a neighborhood in Milwaukee lose out on by not having more white people in a neighborhood?
You know, I just saw this recent movie that featured James Baldwin, and something he said that really stuck with me. It's important for me as a black person to understand everybody's world, but it's not important for you to know what it means for a black person's world to be. And so I think there's some ignorance on the side of people when you don't know how people's lives are and what are some of the challenges they face, and you're not opening to a dialogue that engages you in a way that allows you to think about what are the challenges they face. What is your day to day? I see that with my students, where when we talk about issues of black people or white people in general, what are the differences that we deal on a day to day basis that may affect your well being? I go back to that word often because it all comes down to your well being. And I think you miss out on just understanding what is it that gets you through your day to day that maybe I'm doing that I didn't even know I was doing. And I think people are well-meaning, well-intended, but I do think that we've perpetuated, unfortunately, this issue of segregation in a way that not just the segregation of place, but segregation of mind, segregation of attitudes, and an increased prejudice of who we think people are.
As you say, the situation we have today is just the latest part of a dynamic that's played out over, you know, 300 plus years in this country and, you know, 100 plus years in this city. What is it reasonable to expect out of a single generation that, you know, the time we're living in today?
I think younger people are definitely a positive for me. They make me very optimistic about the future because they do grow. They do require and request that you look at me as gender nonconforming, that you do recognize my pronouns, that you do recognize my race. They're really pushing me in classes to be sure I'm respectful of that. So I think with people who are much younger, they're requiring some of those dialogue and that discussion about what does it mean to be who I am, and don't box me into one space. And I think it's also important for us to recognize race and not to be colorblind. I think that does more harm than good, because there is some historical things that are very important. I also think when you look at films like Hidden Figures, or you look at things like Moonlight, or you look at a variety of films that look at people across race and gender and class, that helps as well. I mean, it may be small, but I think all of those make a difference. And I would hope that people who are adults, who are older adults, are willing to allow people to engage those conversations and are open to those conversations as we move forward.
David Pate, I am always grateful for a chance to chat with you because you have such important insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
David Pate is a professor in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. We spoke with him as part of our series on segregation in Milwaukee.
Don't forget, listen all this week for more installments in our Project Milwaukee Segregation Matters series. And you can also read about the subject and listen back to other stories at WUWM.com.